Blog Talk Radio.
There's a better world to come and tell you why. There's a better world to come and tell you why. We will feed them on the land, on the sea, and in the sky. There's a better world to come and tell you why. There's a better world to come and don't you see? When we'll all be union and we'll all be free. There's a better world to come and don't you see?
Welcome, 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 my friends. Good evening. This is Rick Spezak, News Director of Progressive News Network. I want to welcome you to our show on June 10th. Our special guests tonight are Ellis Robinson of Ruthless. She's going to talk about some interesting things going on with the legislature. And we've also got Dr. Lynn Ringenberg, who's going to be talking about coal ash issues. We're going to have Mr. Drew Martin of the Sierra Club. He's going to be talking about a variety of issues. And then we've got the very informative Ann Fonfa of Annie Appleseed. So it's going to be a great show. And as always, I want to remind you, don't forget to listen to our friends and colleagues on Progressive News. We've got good people like Gwen Holden Berry of Here Be Monsters, Brian Stetton, the charming and talented Susan Nylon, many, many good people out there doing good work. But before we go any further, I also want to thank my colleague and co-producer, Miss Mickey Royce of Media Worldwide. So a couple stories I want to mention to you before we get into our guests. The good people at Buzz Flash from Truth Out have a story about the continued erosion of civil liberties that began during the Bush years and expanded during the Obama administration. It was hopeful that a federal judge would strike down the NDAA. And interestingly enough, we had a Tuesday decision by the New York federal judge, which halted a key terror-fighting feature, so-called, of the 2011 National Defense Authorization Act and is a blow to the Obama administration. The government argued, urged U.S. District Judge Catherine Forrest not to adopt a nationwide ban on the measure, saying the move would be extraordinary and unwarranted. This is about habeas corpus, and the president has said that he would like to be able to detain anybody, anywhere, anytime. Thank you very much. No judicial oversight, none of this tedious jury of your peers and all that sort of thing, and also, of course, the right to kill anybody, anywhere. And while they would like to tell you that it's only a paper moon, only terrorists, of course, it's their definition of who a terrorist is. And as you may know, there's an awful lot of people being detained for doing things like, protesting. Okay. The judge ruled in this case brought by journalists and political activists said the law was too vague and didn't provide clear guidance on whom the government could indefinitely detain. Imagine that. Last month, when Judge Forrest granted standing to the plaintiffs based on their fears of being detained for their writing and political activism, she wrote that before anyone should be subjected to the possibility of indefinite military detention, the Due Process Clause of the Fifth Amendment requires the individual be able to understand what conduct might cause him or her to run afoul of the statute. In other words, secret laws don't make good citizenship and certainly not good legislation. The Obama administration wanted the ruling to apply only to plaintiffs in the case, included noted pro-democracy journalist Chris Hedges. But the federal judge said her striking of the provision applied to all U.S. citizens. So there you go, a blow for habeas corpus. Isn't that nice? So something good on a week where we saw big money, big, huge, seven times big money taking the vote away from the Wisconsin people and keeping that anti-union, anti-working people governor in place in Wisconsin. Another story of interest, when there's stories about the drones, there's a concern out there that war by drone, war by robot is way too easy. And once again, this is an application of those. Oh, I think they're a terrorist. Gee, let's kill them. No trial, no hearing, no charges, just death for them and anybody who happens to be near. So there we go. The hypocrisy of clean coal. This is a story by Heather Taylor Meisel of the NRDC, National Resources Defense Fund, from June 9th. You may have heard about the recent kerfuffle surrounding the Obama administration's late addition of clean coal, quote, clean coal, to the list of energy priorities listed on its website. This has me wondering why so many dirty energy politicians are so excited about clean coal. Imagine that, clean coal. The premise behind clean, this is obviously someone who's never handled coal. The premise behind clean coal is presumably the coal is inherently dirty. But if you do enough to deal with all that filth, you might make it clean. Many would argue that coal can never be clean. But watching the polluters' posse votes in Congress and listening to their rhetoric on the campaign trail, you'd think that coal wasn't even dirty. Now, here's just a selection of the recent times when members of Congress had a chance to go on record in support of cleaning up coal. April 2011, an amendment to the Senate to strip EPA of its ability to reduce carbon pollution received 50 votes. Since coal-fired plants are a large source of carbon pollution, this was pressure to be part of the EPA's war on coal. The House version of the bill passed 255 to 172. In October, the House voted on and passed a bill that would prohibit the EPA from setting strict rules on how to dispose of toxic coal ash, which is filled with arsenic, lead, and mercury. It passed with 267 votes. The Senate companion bill already had 13 co-sponsors. Pro-coal members are now trying to tuck a version of this bill into the transportation bill, since it's unlikely to be signed by law, signed by President Obama. In November, Kentucky Senator Paul Rand offered a resolution that would have stopped life-saving new protections to reduce smog and soot pollution. It garnered 41 votes but fell short of passing. Now Senator Jim Inhofer, a real talented fellow from the right, has filed a new resolution to avoid long overdue limits on mercury pollution from coal-fired plants. You've heard all that clamor among the citizens for, you know, dirtier water, dirtier air. Oh, you didn't hear that either. Okay. Cheap and stable electricity is vital. If all the reactors that previously provided 30% of Japan's electricity are halted or kept dead, Japanese society cannot long survive, said Mr. Noda. This is news on the Fukushima front. He added that some companies could probably move production out of Japan, losing vital jobs as a result. It's my decision that the Ohai reactors 3 and 4 should be restarted to protect the people's livelihood, a controversial move. Indeed, we've heard that all the Japanese reactors have been shut down. There's a new MIT study on radiation risks and protective action guidelines. A new study from MIT scientists suggests that the guidelines the government uses to determine when to evacuate people following a nuclear accident may be too conservative. Oh, they're protecting the nuclear plants, not the people. There we go. The study, led by Bevan Engelward and Jacqueline Yanch, was published in the journal Environmental Health Perspectives, found that when mice were exposed to radiation doses about 400 times greater than background levels for 5 weeks, no DNA damage could be detected. Overview. In the event of nuclear accidents, people are exposed to elevated levels of continuous low-dose radiation. Nevertheless, most of the literature describes the biological effects of acute radiation. Our major aim is to reveal the potential genotoxic effects of low-dose rates exposure. DNA damage and mutations are well established for their carcinogenic effects. However, here we assess the several key markers of DNA damage and DNA damage responses in mice exposed to low-dose radiation. You know, the kind they're always comparing to background radiation. Methods. They study low-dose radiation using a variable low-dose radiation consisting of flood phantoms filled with 125 iodine-containing buffer. Mice were exposed to 0.0002 CGY per minute. That's more or less 400 times background radiation. Continuously over the course of 5 weeks, we assessed the base lesions, micronuclei, homologous recombination using fluorescent yellow direct repeat mice and the transcript levels for several radiation-sensitive genes. Results: under low-dose conditions, we did not observe any changes in the level of DNA nucleobase damage. The micronuclei assay revealed no evidence of low-dose radiation induced DNA fragmentation. Furthermore, there were no evidence of double-strand break-induced homologous recombination. However, finally, low-dose radiation did not include CDKNIA, GADD45A, MDMA2, ATM, or DBD2. Importantly, the same total dose when delivered acutely induced micronuclei and transcription responses. In other words, it made errors in the DNA. Conclusion. Together, these results demonstrate that in an in vitro animal model that lowering the dose rate suppresses the potential deleterious impact of radiation and calls attention to the need for a deeper understanding of the biological impact of low-dose radiation. Okay. Fukushima Forum. Dr. Apsi says that U.S. is feeling the effects of radiation. Dr. John Apsi appeared on the Fukushima Forum on Coast to Coast AM on Saturday, June 9, 2012. That's just a couple days ago, actually yesterday. For more than 30 years, Dr. Apsi, author of Fukushima Meltdown and Modern Radiation, Protecting Ourselves and Our Future Generations. He has specialized in cell regeneration and accelerated wound repair. He appeared on the show to deliver his findings on the effects of Fukushima radioactive fallout on the Japanese people as well as Americans. Dr. Apsi started off by making a few comparisons between Fukushima and Chernobyl. According to Apsley, the fuel pools at Fukushima contained 7 times the amount of nuclear waste as the fuel pools at Chernobyl. There were also 6 times the number of people in the area surrounding Fukushima and the west coast of the United States as there were in the area around Chernobyl. With these figures in mind, Apsley said, we are looking at a catastrophe that can be anywhere from 7 to 42 times worse than Chernobyl. Initial estimates of Chernobyl indicated that only about 64 deaths were related to the incident. That number has since grown to more than 1 million. And if you include the number of people who were crippled or maimed, the number skyrockets to more than 8 million over the 20-year period since the Chernobyl meltdown. Apsley says the Japanese people and the American people are not being told the truth. The Japanese government, in order to avoid panic, is lowering the acceptable levels of radiation in food. However, there is no safe level of radiation. Radiation stays in our systems for up to 250 to 300 years, and whether or not it's 1 rad or 20, it's still radiation. Apsley said that researchers are working off false comparisons to the A-bomb dropped on Nagasaki and when calculating the potential effects of and losses. The A-bomb was a clean bomb, meaning it had more perfect energy conversion, releasing few radioactive particles into the atmosphere. The meltdown of Fukushima is releasing far more radiation into the atmosphere, and if Unit 4 were to tumble, as has been warned, it would have the same effect as 1,100 A-bombs. According to Apsley, more radiation than we've already been led to believe has made its way to the American shores because of the prevailing winds at the time of the Fukushima incident. The west coast of the United States has been exposed to serious levels of radioactive fallout. The hardest hit were Colorado and Wyoming. Surprisingly, Jacksonville, Florida falls into this category too, due to wind currents. But one of the hardest hit states in the nation is Pennsylvania because of the intense rainfall they had in the area approximately 3 weeks after the explosion. Rainfall carried tremendous amounts of radiation into the area. According to Apsley, there's been a 48% increase in infant deaths in the Philadelphia area as a direct result of the radiation. Vancouver, Canada has also experienced a 60% increase in infant death rates. Apsley estimates the United States will see 5 to 15% damage to their overall health compared to what people in Japan will experience. He's predicting 5 to 7 million deaths over the next 20 years in Japan, and another 8 to 25 million will be maimed over that same time period. I'm going to play an interesting excerpt from a conference that was held on Democracy Now! Talking about the Julian Assange case. I know many of you are still following that. He's lost his hearing to be allowed to stay in Britain. So let me bring this on. I think you'll enjoy. This is again from Democracy Now!
Okay.
This is a 4-minute piece.
Glenn, of course, the punishment that he's likely to face in Sweden, even if he is charged, is much less than what he's likely to face if he's extradited to the U.S., where the punishment he faces for possible espionage and conspiracy charges will be much greater. Can you say a little about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two issues of concern with being extradited to Sweden. One is that, although we don't think about Sweden this way, it is nonetheless the case that they have a very oppressive, I would even say borderline barbaric system of pretrial detention, where when somebody is charged with a crime, they are almost, especially in Assange's case, where he's not a Swedish citizen, automatically, more or less, consigned to prison, not released on bail, even though he's proven over the course of the last 2 years that his appearances can be secured. And not only would he likely be in prison pending trial, but he would be in prison under very oppressive conditions where he could be held incommunicado, denied all contact or communication with the outside world. The hearings, pretrial hearings in Sweden, are not that public. They're entirely private. The media, the public has no idea what takes place within these hearings. And given how sensitive this case is, the idea that judicial decisions in Sweden will be made privately and secretly is very alarming. But I think the broader concern is the one that you just raised, which is there's clearly in the United States efforts underway, not just to investigate, but to convene a grand jury, and there are reports, reliable or not, that he's already been indicted with a sealed indictment. There's certainly efforts by the U.S. government to do so, and the real concern is that Sweden, which in the past has demonstrated subservience to the United States with rendition and other things, will hand him over without much of a fight, and he will face life in prison under espionage statutes for doing nothing more than what newspapers do every day, which is publishing classified information in the public interest.
Can you talk about the significance of Hillary Clinton, the Secretary of State, going to Sweden? It's the first time in a very long time that a U.S. Secretary of State is going to Sweden. First, it was announced the High Court would be making its decision today, Glenn. And then Sweden tweeted out that Hillary Clinton would be coming there on Sunday.
Right. I mean, one of the causes for concern is that there's been a flurry of activity recently with FBI agents harassing people who are alleged to have some communication or contact or association with WikiLeaks. A French citizen and an Icelandic citizen, both in the past couple of weeks, have been very aggressively accosted by FBI agents on foreign soil. And now you have these what looks to be high-level meetings between, you know, the State Department, the Secretary of State, and Swedish officials. You know, there really is not much of a secret that the Obama administration is busting at the seams to punish Assange. Remember, this is an administration that has more aggressively than any prior president has punished people who are government employees who have been whistleblowers. And yet here's someone who's not a government employee, has no duty to safeguard classified information, and yet it looks very much like the U.S. government is eager to get their hands on Julian Assange. And that has been the concern all along with going to Sweden. He has never been worried about facing these charges. He feels very confident that he will be ultimately vindicated, that there's nothing to them. I have no opinion one way or the other on that. He's always been willing to face these accusations. The issue has always been that because he's not charged, there's been this extraordinary and unusual effort to get him onto Swedish soil, and the fear has always been that that is just a pretext for turning him over to the United States, something that Britain would have a very hard time doing for a variety of reasons, but that Sweden, as they've proven, can be coerced and bullied and pressured into doing fairly easily. And once he's in the grip of the United States, it's really hard to imagine how he will ever secure his freedom or liberty again, given what the United States has demonstrated it's willing to do in terms of flouting conventions of justice and other things when it comes to people accused of harming national security.
Well, there we go. That was Amy Goodwin and Glenn Greenwald talking about the Assange case. And we do have some additional material from that Democracy Now! Show. The Assange case is so important. It seems that there's a great deal of pressure being put on both Britain and Sweden to get him over here. There's a lot of evidence that there is already a grand jury impaneled to charge him with espionage. And of course, we know that the Bradley Manning hearings are going on. Many of you are probably aware that the Bradley Manning case continues to be a thorn in the side. He has not gotten his day in court yet. They're just beginning some hearings. He's been held under really strenuous conditions. And there were some reports in the news. Kevin Castagnola has reported that they are basically making more constraints on the Bradley Manning case than they actually have on the Guantanamo trials. That these military hearings in Guantanamo, you can listen to the testimony, you can use your computers, you can listen to all the testimony, you have access to documents, but none of that is true with the Manning case. Yeah, if you want to be there, you can't make any notes. There's no information available. It's extraordinary the lengths they're going through to keep that constrained. It seems that our first guest has not managed to make a connection. She must have had something come up. And we expect to hear from Ms. Ringwald, Dr. Lynn Ringenberg, on the coal issue in just a moment. Let me continue to read something else about that coal issue. There doesn't seem to be enough support for clean coal. When you look at the record, there are politicians who want to ensure that coal never has to get cleaner. From mercury that damages the brain of unborn children, to the devastation of mountaintop removal mining, to nasty spills of coal waste, some clean coal advocates seem almost eager to look the other way. Now, surely there are some clean coal proponents who will claim that coal should be cleaned up, but the coal companies and power plants just need more time to do it. Don't be fooled. A special resolution being used to try to stop these pollution rules would stop the EPA from ever issuing a similar rule again. That likely means that if Senator Inhofer gets his way, the mercury at these power plants would spew forth into our families and our environments without limits forever. A Montana Senate candidate, Denny Rayberg, says that he wants to make clean coal safer and more efficient, yet he supported each of the efforts above to limit the EPA's impact on cleaning up coal at power plants and cleaning the air. Pennsylvania Senate candidate Tom Smith is bankrolling his own candidacy with funds he earned as an executive in the coal industry. He sees clean coal as a tremendous opportunity. Do you think he'll support any of the efforts to make coal cleaner? It's time to stop greenwashing. Rebranding dirty old coal as clean coal doesn't magically make the filth disappear. Next time you hear a candidate propound the virtues of clean coal, I urge you to ask whether they see clean coal as a real aspiration for improving public health and the environment, or just a vessel for another empty promise. Many of you may be aware that Netroots has been on this weekend, and there was some definite talk about some of the guests that were there. Just this morning on one of the talk shows on ABC, Van Jones was on, and he put up a good defense for some progressive issues. But as you might imagine, there were four conservatives, including that interesting spokesmodel, Ann Coulter. But he held his own and did a great job. He gave the final speech at Netroots, and I'm sure much of that will be available online, so I urge you to take a listen to that. Also, Eric Schneiderman, who has been made responsible by the president to investigate all those misdeeds by the Wall Street bankers and credit people. And allegedly they finally got one little tiny bank has finally had some officers indicted. So there will be more on that in the next coming days. Something I think you should be concerned about. There's been a lot of talk of this kill list, and I have a piece of tape on that also from the Glenn Greenwald, Amy Goodman show of Democracy Now! But you need to think about as they start spreading these drones across the United States. Of course, just first, these are just for observation, of course. But I want you to think about what kind of country we are becoming when observation on the telephone poles, at the stoplights, and now overhead drones are bringing this total observation, absolute absence of privacy to a street corner near you. Let me go ahead and play this segment of Amy Goodman and Gren Greenwald talking about the kill list. It's a four-minute piece.
According to the Times, Obama signs off on every targeted killing in Yemen and Somalia and the more complex Hormuzki strikes in Pakistan. Individuals on the list include U.S. citizens as well as teenage girls as young as 17 years old. Glenn, can you comment on that?
Well, we, of course, known for all time that the President of the United States believes that he has the power to order people killed, assassinated, in total secrecy, without any due process, without transparency or oversight of any kind. I really do believe it's literally the most radical power that a government and a president can seize, and yet the Obama administration has seized this power and exercised it aggressively with very little controversy. What the New York Times article does is it adds some important, though very disturbing, details. Probably most disturbing of which is that one of the reasons why the Obama administration runs around claiming that the casualties of civilians are so low from their drone attacks, which everybody knows is false, is because they've redefined what a militant is. And a militant, in the eyes of the Obama administration, formally means any male of fighting age, presumably 18 to 40, who is in a strike zone of a missile. So if the United States shoots a missile or detonates a bomb by drone or by aircraft and kills eight or a dozen or two dozen people, without even knowing whom they've killed or anything about them, they will immediately label any male of a certain age a militant by virtue of their proximity to that scene. And what the New York Times article said was that the rationale for this is that they believe that anybody who is even near a terrorist or any terrorist activity is, quote, probably up to no good. Ironically, that is, as Will Bunch of the Philadelphia Daily News pointed out, the exact phrase that George Zimmerman used when describing Trayvon Martin to the 9/11 call, that he must be up to no good. This sort of suspicion that even though we don't know anything about somebody, the mere happenstance of where they are or what they're doing entitles us not just to harbor suspicions about them, but to kill them. And it's amazing that American media outlets continue to use the word militant to describe people who are killed by American drones without knowing their identity, even though we now know that the Obama administration uses that word in an incredibly deceitful and propagandistic way. And the fact that Obama himself is sitting at the top of this pyramid making decisions about life and death, issuing death sentences without a shred of oversight or transparency, really ought to be provoking widespread outrage. And yet, with the exception of a few circles and factions, it really isn't.
And your response to William Daley, the White House chief of staff, in the Times, saying Obama called the decision to strike the U.S.-born cleric Anwar Awlaki an easy one, Glenn?
Well, this is why I wrote yesterday. You know, I think one of the things that the New York Times article did was shed light on President Obama's character. You know, we can talk a lot about his policies, and that usually is what's most important. We've known that he's been embracing these radical theories of executive power that even George Bush's former CIA and NSA chief, General Michael Hayden, has lavishly praised, and other Bush officials are over the moon about in terms of President Obama endorsing them. So we know his policies have been extremist and radical. But here you have one of the most controversial things, as I said earlier, that a president can do, order an American citizen assassinated by the CIA in total secrecy with no due process, never been charged with any crime, even though they could charge him if they really had evidence, as they claim, that he was guilty of plotting terrorist attacks. And instead of charging him, they simply secretly ordered his assassination. And it turns out that there was no struggling in terms of the difficult constitutional and ethical and legal issues this obviously presents. According to the president's own aides, they're boasting to the New York Times that he declared that this was a, quote, easy decision, not anything that he struggled with, something that he made quite easily. And so we find out that not only is he exercising his radical powers, he's not even having any struggles with conscience or constitutional questions or legal or intellectual quandaries about it. It's something that, as his national security advisor Tom Donilon also bragged to the New York Times about, it shows how, quote, comfortable he is using force, even against American citizens. And that, I think, reflects really on the type of person that occupies the Oval Office.
Hi, did you see my message? Well, no, ma'am, not at all. Okay, here's what you should have her do. Have her call my house number and I'll get her in somehow. 772-546-1534.
Okay, a little technical difficulty there. Seems that my call-in guests are not showing up on the board. These things happen. So we'll have to see what happens next. Let me go ahead and put on a little something else, and we will bring on our guest when she calls on line B. It's always a little something we can do. We are not without our technical alternatives, huh? Okay, let me put this on until we get another call from Alice Robinson, who's tried to call in on the main number.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. And we are joined in Britain by one of the attorneys for Julian Assange, Helena Kennedy. When the judge announced the Supreme Court's decision to uphold Assange's extradition, he invoked the 1957 European Convention on Extradition. I want to ask Helena Kennedy about the significance of that convention and why it was put into effect. We're going to just go to a clip of the ruling first. This is Lord Nicholas Phillips, president of the Supreme Court in Britain.
The Swedish public prosecutor has requested the extradition of Mr. Assange on charges of serious sexual offences. That request has raised a point of law of general public importance. It is not a point in respect of which the particular facts of Mr. Assange's case have any relevance. This summary is about that point of law. It used to be the case that this country would not extradite a person to another European country until a court here had considered the evidence against that person. The court would not approve extradition unless the evidence justified his being subjected to a criminal trial. All that changed in 2001 when we gave effect to the 1957 European Convention on Extradition.
That's Lord Nicholas Phillips, president of the Supreme Court in Britain, explaining the decision to extradite Julian Assange, the founder of WikiLeaks, to Sweden. Helena Kennedy, you're one of the members of Julian Assange's legal team. Can you respond to the decision that was just handed down hours before this broadcast?
Well, I'm a consultant to the team, and extradition is one of the areas of law that I have some practice and knowledge of. And it's right that it's comparatively recently that we have become much more closely involved in legal arrangements with the rest of Europe about the handing over of persons sought for questioning or for proceeding on criminal trial on a much more familiar basis, so that we do it with little examination of evidence, and the idea is that we respect the legal systems of these other countries to be just and fair, even if they're very different from ours. And the problem about that is, of course, in other parts of Europe, we don't have a common law system. In fact, the American system is much closer to the British system. And there's a civil law system where the whole arrangement is a lot different.
Hello, it's Alice.
And so one of
Dr. Ringenberg.
Oh, hi, Dr. Ringenberg. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Well, we're having a little technical difficulty, but I think we can keep the show going. Thanks so much for calling. I understand you have some information for us about the coal situation.
Well, I do, Richard, and thanks for having me on. I just wanted all of your listeners to be aware of the House Transportation Bill that's working its way through Congress, and it's H.R. 4348, and it has a rather nasty amendment to it, Title V. And what Title V does is really, it's unprecedented to allow the coal-fired power plants to continue to dump coal ash like they've been doing unregulated for years and years. And this particular amendment would be permanently remove the EPA from any authority to establish consistent national standards for coal ash disposal. And as you framed it, and I know I'll try and be brief because I know you're going to be running a little behind probably, but you framed the issue very well earlier, and I think the only thing I would clarify is that clean coal is really an oxymoron. I mean, there's no such thing ever as clean coal, you know?
Well, I grew up in Western Pennsylvania, so I'm familiar with both soft coal and hard coal, and yeah, you're absolutely right.
And I know the commercials always show clean coal, but this particular, you know, the transportation bill alone is a good thing. It would provide jobs, many, many jobs for people across the country, but this attachment to it would devastate the public's health. And, of course, as a physician, you know, that's what I'm most concerned about, because coal ash, you know, and coal ash, for the listeners, I mean, every coal-fired power plant in the country, and there are just a little under, I think, 500 of them in the country, and there are about, I think, 30 in the state of Florida that are coal-fired generating units at 14 different locations. But these things dump millions and millions and billions of toxic waste, and coal ash contains some of the world's deadliest toxins like arsenic and lead and mercury and cadmium and chromium and selenium and thallium and, you know, all sorts of really ugly things, and it's totally unregulated. I mean, your garbage is better regulated than coal ash.
I'm sure that's not by accident.
Oh, I'm sure it's not. And so what we're really asking is for folks, I mean, these chemicals, all obviously the coal ash, it's either put in ponds of water. You remember a couple, what, in 08, when the big plant in Tennessee dumped, what, a billion gallons of toxic sludge in Kingston, Tennessee at that plant?
Yeah.
Just wiped out the whole area. Certainly the potential there at other places as well, and this stuff is leaking into the groundwater, it's you know, it's blowing in the atmosphere, people are sucking it in their lungs, and so I think it's really important for folks to call their congressman or woman and just really say, look, House Transportation Bill is great, we don't want the Title V amendment that prohibits the EPA from ever visiting this ash rule again. I mean, it's crazy.
Have you heard anything about the administration's stand on it?
I have not. We sent, when I say we, you know, I represent Physicians for Social Responsibility in Florida. And we, along with, it was a bunch of probably 38 or so environmental groups, sent a letter to Obama, and we also have sent one to the congressional conferees, the Senate conferees, just last week. But I don't have any feedback on that yet.
Well, I hope you'll call us back and let us know what you hear, okay?
We will. We'll do. So just again, if your listeners can call and say, please don't put Title V on the House Transportation Bill.
Well, thank you so much. I sure appreciate your call. And you call back again often, okay?
Okay, thanks, Richard.
Talk to you. Okay, you take care, Doctor.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, well, that was Dr. Ringenberg from the Physicians for Social Responsibility. Ellis, if you're out there, feel free to call in on the number I gave you. And I'm sure that if you're tied up at this point, we appreciate all your time, all our guests who've tried to call in. And unfortunately, like I say, there seems to be a technical snafu with the official call-in. So hopefully we can get that workaround going and have our next caller make it in. another issue I think that bears mentioning, and it's another one of those critical ones. There's been quite a bit of information available out there about mountaintop removal, where these mining companies have decided. Hold on one second. I think that's probably our next caller. Hello, is this Ellis? Hello, is this Ellis?
If you needed somebody, I could call earlier, but I can call back.
Well, Ann, that's just fine. We'll go ahead and take you now. You've got an update for us, I think.
Yeah, about the environmental aspects of cancer.
Please, go ahead.
Okay. So I was just listening to the last speaker, and one of the things she talked about was cadmium. Cadmium is implicated in breast cancer, and it's something that raises estrogen, and estrogen is a known cause of breast cancer, and cadmium is rarely considered as one of the aspects. But cancer in general has connections to the environment, and breast cancer particularly. There's a place called Camp Lejeune, a military camp, that's a Marine camp, I believe.
Right.
They have a tremendous amount of breast cancer cases. It's quite shocking. They have over 90 men who are on their list, and that's all the men who are alive. I'm quite sure there's plenty of men who died of breast cancer without even, you know, having an awareness before it happened. Since one man is diagnosed for every woman, 1,000 women, that means it's a huge, huge cluster. And there's also a petition going around on change.org right now talking about the other illnesses, children's cancers and so on, that are taking place at people who either served on the camp, whose parents served in the camp, and clearly there's environmental connections to that. It's pretty shocking. And we're all hoping that the change.org petition will be taken up. I put it onto Facebook and a couple of other, you know, tweeted it naturally, trying to get it circulated.
I understand you have some information on some suggestions of either foods to avoid or foods to consume to help combat breast cancer.
Yeah, here's one thing. I mean, well, several things, but one thing that people can do to remove heavy metals from their bodies is to eat cilantro, dandelion leaves, or parsley. Any of those three bind to heavy metal and actually help the body excrete it quickly. So that's cilantro, dandelion leaves, and parsley. And all of them are pretty active. There's also something called chlorella, C-H-L-O-R-E-L-L-A, which is a green powder coming from, is plant-based, and that also helps people to detox from heavy metals. Additionally, you know, there's the internal environment, and that is when we know that it's suggested that at least 30% of cancer is related to what we eat or don't eat. So the key thing is to eat lots of fresh fruits and vegetables. I totally suggest organic, and I eat organic as much as I possibly can. There's a real big difference because of the pesticides, and that's an environmental factor as well. The other problem we have with the environment is that when it's studied in any way, science is set up to study one test animal, usually a mouse, with one chemical, one time. And obviously that's nothing like the real life of people who have developed cancer, because we're exposed to thousands of chemicals every single day over our whole lives. And there's some understanding now that your exposure in utero, which of course you can't do a damn thing about, may really be a factor. But eating real fruits and vegetables, organic whenever possible and often, the National Cancer Institute actually suggests 5 to 9 as a minimum. And it's possible with something, you know, to eat that way to make a difference. Also, we suggest that the group I run, AnnieAppleseedProject.org, that exercise combined with that, and you have to be an athlete, you just have to be physically active, eating fruits and vegetables, being physically active, and really, you know, crazily but true, learning to relax and enjoy your life, and it's how you deal with stress that also matters. We know those three things affect your genes as much as any chemical that we've developed on Earth. But it's really a good idea to, you know, to be proactively protecting yourself.
Well, thank you so much. I really got a kick out of your mentioning that one chemical at a time, because that's another way to get around that, it's just comparable to background radiation. Well, how many things are additive? Radiation, like the chemistry, is an additive phenomenon. Well, thanks for pointing that out.
Yeah, it's not studied, so they'll never, you know, it's easy for researchers or people who are trying to keep us from thinking will say, well, there's no evidence. Well, there isn't because, A, they're not looking for it, and, B, they don't know how to find it. So, you know, that's very unfortunate, and we can't buy into that. We have to be strongly aware that they're looking at it in the wrong way, and they're doing that because it's easier, and they're never going to find anything.
Well, thank you so much, Anne. We sure appreciate it. Any other thoughts you want to leave our audience with?
Well, you know, the key to good health is to focus on your happiness, be active, eat fruits and vegetables. That's it. It's very simple.
So they can get more information by going to?
AnnieAppleseedProject.org.
Okay. Thank you so much, Anne.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Okay. Bye-bye. Well, look at that. Our guests are such a resilient lot, just like those progressives out there going to the B mode to work around this little technology faux pas. Okay. So there we go. I think we may have Ellis here. Good evening. Is this Ellis?
I'm sorry. This is Drew Martin.
Oh, that's okay, Drew. Don't be sorry at all. Welcome, Drew.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here.
So tell us, what news do you have for us, sir?
Well, I just had two interesting meetings at the Sierra Club. The first was with our population committee, and the Sierra Club is one of only two or three environmental groups that has a position on population issues, even though population is extremely important. The other was a meeting that the Sierra Club had, a joint meeting with the Communication Workers of America, and we're working together because we feel that many of our issues are similar. So those are two very interesting meetings we just had, and we're trying to branch out and work more and more with, as the Sierra Club is looking to move into the election. The Sierra Club is one of the few environmental groups that actually endorses candidates.
Well, that's fantastic. Tell me, does the Sierra Club have a position on this interesting approach to democracy where every 4 years the Republicans decide that there's just too many voters?
Well, we're, of course, in a meeting with the Communication Workers of America, we talked about that, this whole idea of voter suppression. And it's very interesting because these voters that they're always looking at are voters that are Democrat voters. And that is one of the reasons that Republicans, of course, want to suppress voters. And this goes back many, many years. Florida's had a long history of voter suppression. And it's very unfortunate. We need to get past this philosophy of trying to keep people from voting. We want Americans to vote, and both parties should want Americans to vote. And the argument that there are some people in the rolls, well, I think so far they've found 10 or 11 people out of a state with over a million residents. So I don't think this is a serious issue right now as far as for the Republicans, but it is a serious issue for the Democrats because we're losing people that are voters.
You know, I think there's another question I want to raise with you. From time to time, you know, with this sewage outflow approach to treating waste products, from time to time we hear about the beaches unsafe to swim in. But I understand there's been some changes in regulations. Can you talk about that, or is that outside your area of focus?
I can tell you that with the budget cutbacks in the state of Florida, that they've stopped testing.
Oh, well.
Does
that work like the those FCAT tests where we're going to just declare by adjusting the rules that everything's okay?
Right. I mean, I think what the governor's trying to do is not do any testing. And this is, right now the DEP is coming out with their own set of rules. The Sierra Club and several other groups with the help of Earth Justice sued to bring the EPA into Florida to enforce the Clean Water Act. What is happening is that the state of Florida has been resisting that and trying to come up with their own protocols. Now, the state of Florida had what is called a narrative where you basically just declare the water swimmable, fishable, and we just found that doesn't work. You need a numeric standard that a scientist can look at. So the EPA lawsuit was to force these numeric standards. The state has come back and said, well, they'll accept the standards, but they won't declare a water body out of, to be unclean until it's absolutely beyond the point of recovering it. And that's one of the problems that we think that these standards should be enforced before a water body is impaired, not, you know, wait till a water body is impaired and then declare it, you know, polluted.
I once tracked down a wildlife biology biologist whose focus was water quality at the state level. And when I asked and was asking questions about tracking this fella down, all the wildlife people said, oh, you'll never get this guy to talk on air. And when I finally did get him to talk, this happened to be on a television show, he said, well, they tend to not let me go out and talk in public. And you didn't have to listen to him for more than a few minutes to find out why. Because he was telling me that with the mercury levels, the lead levels in Florida waters, both salt and fresh, that he didn't recommend eating anything except dolphin, which for some reason doesn't bioaccumulate mercury.
Sure.
The thing that he was saying was that since most of the typical game fish that people prize, grouper, the snapper, etc., these being predator fish are at the top of the food chain and therefore are huge bioaccumulators. And it was certainly gave one pause, and you don't have to think too hard to figure out why the state doesn't lift this fellow out very often.
Well, that's one of the problems, and a lot of people don't realize that things like lead and mercury cause learning disabilities, and we are putting so much money into our school system, but if we have students that have learning disabilities because of the fish they're eating, that's a serious expense for the state of Florida.
Well, I suppose you could, if you were very cynical, say, well, listen, the good thing about mercury poison is you'll never notice you're getting dumber.
Well, that may be true, but it's very serious. We have very serious pollution issues in the state of Florida, and the governor is trying to move backwards. As we know, there was just an issue recently where the head of issuing permits for wetlands was suspended because she opposed the issuing of a permit for mitigation for wetlands to land that was dry and would never be a wetland. So we have a lot going on at the level of the state with the DEP that we're very concerned about.
What other issues are you looking at as we approach the summer?
Well, we're very concerned about water quality more than anything else. And I think that what's happening right now is that we're seeing the state DEP moving backwards on water quality, particularly with the issues of phosphorus and nitrogen. And those two are very high pollutants. When phosphorus and nitrogen accumulate in water bodies, we will end up seeing what are known as algal blooms. And so that's the issue that we're most concerned about. The other thing, of course, we're very seriously concerned about are wildlife issues. And the Florida panther is under a great deal of impact right now. A number of panthers have been killed. We did get some good news that a piece of land that is a entryway for panthers to move past the area that they live in now was purchased by the state and the federal government in combination with the wildlife conservancy groups, and so that will help the panthers. But the panther is in a great deal of stress. We also have a situation where the black bear, the Fish and Wildlife Commission is trying to open the black bear to hunting, and the black bear is also under a great deal of stress.
Well, thank you so much, Drew. I sure appreciate your input. And we want you to come back often and keep us informed of the things we need to know about. If there was one thing you would urge my guests to call on or follow up with, what issue should they follow up with right now?
I think right now people should be putting pressure on the state to improve water quality standards. And that's the most important thing, because water quality is something that we're all dependent on, both for drinking water and for swimming and fishing.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Drew. We sure appreciate your guesting.
You're welcome.
You have a good night, sir.
You too.
Bye-bye. Okay. Well, that was fantastic. Another good report on our environmental issues. Hopefully, Ellis, if you're out there, feel free to give me a call on that other number I gave you, and we'll get you on the air, and you can give us that update. Another issue I started to talk about before we got that call from Drew was when the mountaintop removal issue came up in a hearing before Congress. There was a woman whose name escapes me right now who was very involved in investigating and documenting the cases of pollution from the mountaintop removal. Now, some of you may think that's pretty far removed from Florida, but these are issues that are important, and you'll see exactly what happened. When she was showing her slideshow to the congressman, one of the Republicans got all up in arms because there was a picture of a young lady, a child, in a bathtub. And the point of that photograph of this young girl in the bathtub was the water that her family needed to use. The only water available for them to bathe in was absolutely filthy, dirty, brown water. That's the only water available to them. And instead of taking note of the quality of the water, in other words, the issue of mountaintop removal and the impact it has on the environment, instead, these congressmen want to have an investigation on the child pornography aspect of this photograph. Now, you can imagine, once again, just like the young woman who testified on access to birth control, here we have these fake conservatives pretending to be concerned about something when, in fact, this is strictly a ruse to detract from the important issues at hand. So I want to urge you, do not take a back seat. Do not let yourself be misled and depressed by some of the foolishness that's going on. Hold on one second. Good evening. Is this Ellis?
It is.
Hey, fantastic. Ladies and gentlemen, let me bring you Ellis Robinson of Ruthless Florida. Ellis, what's going on?
Well, thank you. I'm sorry we had such a mix-up at the beginning of the show.
Hey,
I'm
it's
getting
okay.
On.
Just technical.
And I'm glad you could fit me in. I was calling to let you know about how the qualifying did for our candidates. As you and your listeners are aware, candidates needed to qualify as of Friday at noon to be in the state legislature or for many, in fact, most county and local races as well, although there aren't as many local races in this cycle as they normally would be. So that meant that by the time noon on Friday came along, we know what the makeup of the legislature candidates will be as we move forward. So exciting week as people came in, things shifted around, people popped up unexpectedly. People disappeared, a lot of things that were absolutely waiting until the last minute.
So give us the names of those good people that you've been supporting who got on the list.
Yes, well, we're very excited. Why should we be excited about Democratic women who get on the list? Well, Democratic women are the most progressive voters out there.
God bless them all.
And yes, as on average, they are the most progressive there are. And we were thrilled that we actually have 46 seats with a Democratic woman sitting in there and ready to run. And in fact, three of those seats our members have already been elected because they were unopposed at the last minute.
Oh, that's fantastic. You know, I'd like you to call back next week, if you could, and give us the list of people we need to support, the good people that Ruth List has been backing.
Will do.
Go ahead. You've got about 2 minutes, dear. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. No, that's fine. I think that, you know, one of the things that's very exciting, and as we all worked on Fair Districts Florida, we are actually seeing the fruits of those labors now, and that is that there are many, many more competitive seats than there were before. We didn't get candidates for all of them, and there aren't Democratic candidates running in all of them, but we got a lot more filled than we have in the past, and it's very exciting because the ones that are filled are ones we can win.
That's great. Boy, that's some good news.
It is, and I think that a key piece for your listeners to keep in mind is that there's a magic number at 40% plus one. For the last two decades, Democrats have only been able to hold less than a third of the seats in each house of the state legislature, and that meant that basically they had no power and couldn't stop anything. Once we get to 40% plus one, we can actually stop some of the terrible proposals for amendments to the Constitution that have been going on the ballot. And that becomes really critical, not only because we'll not have to deal with those terrible things anymore, and there are 11 of them on the ballot this round, but also we won't be having to spend as much money fighting them, which is part of the strategy of the radical right wing, is to get progressives out there trying to fight these bad things instead of
working our agenda
on getting candidates elected instead.
Okay, well, thank you so much. Sure appreciate you able to call in. Thanks again, Alice.
You bet. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, I want to thank you again for joining us. This is Rick Spezak, News Director of Progressive News Network, and we hope you'll tune in again next week. Progressive News Network, good news from good progressives working every day to make this a better world. Thank you so much. There's a better world a coming. Well, we managed to survive. You know what else is strange? That Drew called in at 10 minutes till. And I got him. And he called in, no problem. And he said, well, listen, I'm calling early. He goes, what time do I actually supposed to call in? I go, dude, if you want to hang for 35 minutes, you're welcome. But damn. He goes, no, I'll call back. So, I mean, look at that. Here, you know. Yeah. Yeah. Hey, live radio, right? Thank you for your help, my dear. Yeah, we got them all on. Well, okay. And you know, thanks so much for that heads up, because I wouldn't have otherwise, I wasn't going to plan on doing any audio elements. And if you hadn't called me earlier and said, you know, there was this really kind of weird thing, I wasn't going to prepare any additional audio elements, but thank goodness you did, and I did. So I had that other stuff to play. since we had such a good house of people who I thought were, you know, rock solid, I didn't even, I only came up with 6 pages of pre-material, and it was really just 6 stories. I mean, I normally have 15, 20 stories, but they were all kind of longish, so I only had 6 pages, and I got through that faster than I was hoping. It sure is.